He's in there laughing his ass off because he knows more about the law than you do.
I'm here live. I'm not a cat.
My law is thy legal.
I will make it legal.
Objection, Your Honor! Strangling a witness!
I'm going to allow it.
We disagree.
That's it? We disagree?
Well, I can't say we agree. That's how I lost my first 10 cases.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, a podcast that pairs a comedian with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 500. Woo! Woo! How's it going, Andrew?
Well, I began as fantastic, and now I've moved up to whatever the level is above that of, it's wow. Our 500th show. I'm super excited, and obviously I'm excited for our subject matter.
There's been a level beyond fantastic this whole time.
I know, and I haven't been there.
And you're just now kicking it into gear. Oh, 500. And we are celebrating by me recording on worse audio quality on a laptop out at Disneyland. That's why we thought that would be the best way.
You are celebrating in Disneyland. So that's, you know, that's a good way to celebrate our 500th episode.
I am in a full body cast. We're done. This is our traveling back day. This is real breaking news for you here. Sunday, when we got here, 10,000 steps. Monday, 22,000 steps. Yeah. Tuesday, 16,000. Wednesday, 28,000. All of that while pushing 80 pounds of solid kid in a stroller that wasn't very good. So I'm dead. I'm in a full body cast.
Need to have a day off in the middle of that, right? Like three straight days.
That's just a good idea.
It's nuts. It's nuts. You can't, I don't know. Maybe somebody can do it, but you know, I'm an old man, so.
Well, it's hard because we go with our friends who are the Disney nuts, you know, who are people without kids, which is great. I love it. It's absolutely great. But you know, they don't have kids, so they're like, we'll do 48 straight hours of what we'll sleep in the park and then get, you know, and it's like, oh man, this is a lot harder for us, but that's okay. It was a ton of fun. It was magical. I loved it. And now I'm ready for episode 500 of our show. I can't even believe it. I didn't get you anything. Actually, I did get you this cake and the candles are going. If you'd like me to eat it for you here, Andrew, say
absolutely nothing. Yeah, right. Well, I got you a present, Thomas.
Ooh, what is it?
And that present is our long-awaited Eminent Domain episode.
No way. You did it.
I did.
I don't believe it. What a landmark moment for our show. We'll no longer have that joke. Actually, you know what? Even if we do Eminent Domain, we should still have that be the joke that got to
no,
it.
No, obviously.
Okay, I solved it. All right, well, I'm so excited. We're really doing Eminent Domain. I can't believe 500 episodes in, finally. Let's do it, everybody. Episode 500, Eminent Domain. Here we go. Okay, I had to do that. My hands were tied. That had to be done, everybody. But no, it's not really just a Rickroll. We're actually also doing it. It's the best of both worlds. You get Rickrolled, which is just
delightful.
Great.
Right.
There's no downside to that. And we're still going to do Eminent Domain.
This is not the My Cousin Vinny of...
Yeah, wait, should we Rickroll him one more time? Or just, no, that's okay. We'll just
this
do
whole
the
episode
one.
Will be just nothing but Rick Astley. I could go with that. All right. So here's the promise that I'm going to make to you, I hope to bring you along, and that is that perhaps the most maligned Supreme Court decision of the 21st century, Kelo versus City of New London, is not only correct, but something that we should mourn once this activist Supreme Court overturns it, which it almost certainly will in the next year or two. I realize that's kind of a heavy burden.
Yeah.
And I want
a bummer.
I want to get to that because Kylo versus City of New London, expanding the powers of eminent domain, is one of those rare Supreme Court decisions that has pretty much received criticism from both sides of the political spectrum. Although the second you scratch beneath the surface, you realize that almost all of the energy, particularly in legal journals, comes from the libertarian right. Right. It is. They have co-opted some social consciousness on the left, but there aren't deep, well-thought left critiques of the Kylo decision. Go ahead. Sorry, didn't mean to interrupt.
Well, I'll step on the rake that I always do to try to set up the show, but I can't remember if I mentioned this, but I live close-ish to a river, like maybe, I don't know, half mile away. And so like right on our commute, to take the kids to school, for Lydia to go to work, all that kind of thing, we go by the river, like we drive over to the river, go by it. And recently they eminent domained a bunch of houses, like nice houses that were on the side of the river, the other, not the riverside, because that's the like the rich people, they didn't get eminent domain, but like just on the other side. And there were houses one day, and then they're like, we need to build the levee more. And then, like, you don't have houses anymore. And they just freaking demolished them. The whole time, I was like, this can't really be happening, right? They don't just take people's houses away. But nope, gone. Just a bunch of houses. One day they're there. Next day they're gone. It was crazy. So the snake that says, don't tread on me, says, should we allow this, Andrew? Is this an outrage?
So the answer to that is the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution. And here's the relevant provisions that have justified the limits on eminent domain since the founding of the country. Okay, and that is the Fifth Amendment says no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Right, so they can't take your property. Then it says nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. So think of that second clause as modifying the first. And basically, it is a compelled sale, right? So in other words, if there is a public use, like expanding a levee, right, they can indeed take your property, even if you'd rather not sell, but they have to pay you fair market value for it. They have to pay you just compensation. Now, does that still represent a deprivation of liberty? I certainly would argue that it does. The question is kind of where does that rank in a society in terms of compared to other deprivations of, you know, your general liberty that you might think about, right? So to figure that out, there are really two kinds of questions when the government does stuff. The first is it a taking of your property at all? If it's not, and this is a crucial threshold question, because if it's not a taking, then that second clause isn't implicated and you get nothing, right? And I'm going to,
I'm going to tell you
a story about that, right? Okay. Exactly.
Wow.
If it is a taking, then the question is it a justified taking under the public use provision? And then how are you compensated for that taking? And generally, in those sorts of cases, the remedy, if the underlying state actor does not agree that their action constitutes a taking, the remedy is injunctive relief, right? You stop the government from doing that thing until you can have some kind of hearing as to what constitutes just compensation, the fair market value.
Is the government assholes about this? Like, how you know how we're like, everybody fights everything in court? I wonder, do they demolish your house and they're like, we didn't take it? Do they go try to save money? You know, like, I don't know.
So it's a great question. And I think that sort of nicely sets up that the first area of what constitutes a taking. Demolishing your house, right? Condemning it, bulldozing it. Those sorts of things fall under the category of what we might call physical intrusions, right? And until 1922, physical intrusion was the only thing that we thought constituted a taking of your property. And let me give you an example of just how rigorous the physical intrusion doctrine goes. I would refer you to a case called Loretto versus Teleprompter Manhattan Cable TV Corporation from 1982. Right. So
the government was like, we need your teleprompters.
Well, the cable company was called Teleprompter Cable. It was really weird. Anyway, what happened was New York passed a law. Okay, they passed a law in 1973 that says a landlord may not interfere with the installation of cable television facilities upon his property or premises and may not demand payment from any tenant for permitting cable or demand payment from any cable TV company in excess of what the state commission determines to be a reasonable amount of compensation. And that was a dollar. So let's think about this for a minute. The reason this case came about was because tenants, right, people renting property in New York City, which, by the way, is the only way 99.9% of New York City, you know, you get to live in New York City in the 70s.
Kushners have everything. Yeah, right.
They were like, we'd like to have cable on our premises. Why would they want to have cable on their premises? Because, you know, back then you had three channels if you didn't have cable. And so they would hire the cable company to come out and run the cable line into that. And then, you know, that was a physical intrusion in two ways. Number one, they ran a cable across the roof of these apartment buildings and brownstones that were rented out. And number two, they installed two separate little cable boxes on the wall of the building. Those cable boxes were 4 inches by 4 inches by 4 inches. So pretty minor. Right?
I think I see where this is going.
Yeah. And so a bunch of landlords were like, well, I didn't give you tenant permission to let the cable company onto my property. You've got to run that through me. And right. Like landlords being jerks, which, you know, not all landlords are jerks, but certainly some are. and so they were trying, you know, there was a war back and forth between tenants and landlords as to, you know, can the landlord require, you know, increase your rent or, you know, otherwise extort you into paying more money to install the cable. And this was enough of a problem that the state legislature in New York enacted Executive Law Section 828, which I read to you previously, said, no, landlord, like, you can't stop the cable. This is not a big deal. Let your tenants have cable, right? It didn't require them to pay for their tenants' cable or anything like that. Well, the New York landlords sued, went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, no, this is definitely 100% a taking of your property because you previously had, you know, whatever the cubic footage is of your property, and now you have, and they computed it, it was 1.12 cubic feet, but you have 1.12 less cubic feet of your property now that they've installed the two boxes.
If a large crow flies onto your property, is that you've now lost like 1.12 cubic feet?
If the government were to install
a crow on your property
under this decision, yes.
Well, hold on. But I'm sure I missed something. How is this the government? I thought this was people just trying to install cable.
This was the government saying that you, as the landlord, cannot prevent them, the tenant, from installing the cable, right? So, it is absolutely – I love that you ask that question that way because most of these eminent domain questions involve legislation that is trying to protect one party's property interest at the expense of another, which is something the libertarians never, ever tell you, particularly when they're criticizing Kelo versus City of New London, which I promise we will get to by the end of the story. Right? It's like Grover is the monster at the end of the book, right? Yeah, that's where we're headed. Okay. Now, that's how broadly physical takings are construed in the law. The second question is, could you imagine an action by the state that amounts to taking your private property for public use that doesn't involve, you know, physically coming on and sticking a box on your property? And I think the answer to that is pretty obviously yes, right? Like you could see how regulations might increase or decrease. Well, go ahead.
I don't know if this is where you're going, but with my government crow thing, I just realized, like, what about, like, endangered species stuff? Is that, like, okay, we've decided that this thing that might live on your, say, your property or something is now protected. Is that sort of a takings?
That is an awesome question, and I think if you let me go through the regulatory section. No. Here's the short answer to that. If the government seizes your property and says, we need, this is a previously undiagnosed federally protected wetland. Yes, they can seize your property, condemn it, tear down the building. But again, you get compensated for that, right? You get paid for the fair market value of your house. And then they can maintain that as a federally protected wetland. If they want not to pay you, then they could regulate the use of your property. And that will fall under this second category, which we ask is something a regulatory taking. It is really easy to imagine your regulations of, you know, you might say, oh, there's a marsh behind your house that is a federally protected wetland, so we're not going to let you put in an in-ground swimming pool, right? That activity, the earth moving, would disturb the marsh. And so even if you have a huge backyard, right, you can't, we're going to deny you the permit. You can't build a swimming pool.
You've taken my hypothetical pool.
You've taken the hypothetical pool. That's exactly right.
It was going to be a mega babe layer, so I better get paid for that, you know? I'm just trying to come up with ways to get more money from the government.
You might say, like, I bought this house planning to put a pool in the backyard, and then you've taken that away. Or let me give you a...
I was going to dig a 400-foot pool.
Well...
Deep.
Let me give you...
Can you juice the numbers a little bit?
A real-world example. I used to live just outside of Olney, Maryland, which I've said before. So yes, the Fallout games have fantastic nostalgia for me. And it used to be to get to my neighborhood from I-95, right, the largest interstate on the East Coast, you had to take highway, and you kept taking the highway until it narrowed down to this one-lane road. And then you had to follow the one-lane road for another like 7 miles. And then it intersected the largest street, Lay Hill Road. And at that intersection was this delightful little old-timey house called the Red Door Store. And indeed, it had a big, bright red door. And it was like a turn of the 20th century general store. In fact, had been in continuous operation for more than a century. And they sold, you know, beer and wine and some rudimentary groceries. And you get the sense. And I would sometimes stop there on the way home from work to, you know, pick up a six-pack or whatever. About a year after I bought the house, in fact, one of the reasons I bought the house, the state of Maryland finished what was called the Intercounty Connector, Route 200. And so now there was an off-ramp right in my neighborhood. I could get right off of 95, take 200, get off on Lay Hill Road without ever having to drive down that, you know, 7 mile.
So this is like a bypass creates a ghost town situation?
That's exactly what happened. So, So a couple months later, I was driving that way.
Or Red Door. You walk over, it's just a red door in the dirt, you know, like just loot. You're like, where'd it go? It's gone.
Yeah. They completely shut down, was out of business.
Wow.
And it makes total sense, right? Like if you're not, it was kind of a throwback anyway, and if people aren't being diverted onto the road. So that regulation, building a new road, diverted a ton of traffic, all of the commercially viable traffic away from the Red Door Store, reduced the economic value of running that building down to zero. Is that a taking? What do you think?
It feels like a takings. But I also feel like we've talked about this, and I'm worried that there's a bad end to the story, which is like, because it's not a direct thing, like the government didn't literally take anything, like your business is still there, technically people could still drive out to you. I'm worried that maybe the government's going to be like, sorry, that's not technically a taking, this is just bad luck, you know, sorry, bucko, go build a red door somewhere else.
So put a pin in that. Because I want us to time travel back to 1922. And this is a decision from one of our most famous Supreme Court justices, perhaps the most overrated Supreme Court justice in history, Oliver Wendell Holmes, right?
Oliver Wendell, okay.
Whom we've previously criticized for Schenck v. U.S., saying that was the good old fire in a crowded theater means you can't distribute socialist literature during World War I. Although, in fairness, I would point out Holmes became more of a free speech advocate in his later years. But nevertheless, he wrote the most misused, misquoted, terrible opinion on free speech ever, Schenck v. U.S. And he wrote Buck versus Bell, which upheld the mandatory sterilization under an explicitly eugenics reason, featuring the line, three generations of imbeciles is enough. Oliver Wendell Holmes. Anyway, now that I've poisoned the well, let's talk about the case.
Well, you're going to have to pay me for that. I don't have a well anymore.
That's right. Let's talk about Pennsylvania Coal Company versus Mann. This is Simpsons level super villainy of the sort that you would expect from the turn of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century.
This is Monty Burns stuff.
Yes.
Okay.
So here's what happened. The Pennsylvania Coal Company owned a bunch of land, and then they conveyed the surface land to a bunch of people to build houses. And then the deed conveys the surface, but reserves the right to remove all the coal out from underneath and says, you know, you're taking the premises with the risk that you waive all claim for damages against anything that might come from mining out the coal. So I don't know if you remember the Simpsons episode with the like slant mining, you know, slant drilling of the oil that causes the school to fall.
Yeah.
That's exactly what was at risk here. So 1878, you couldn't slant mine like that. So a bunch of people bought all these houses. By 1920, you could, and the coal company was about to extract all this coal that would very likely cause houses to collapse into the earth.
See, my mind went to the There Will Be Blood, where it's like, I take my straw, I drink your milkshake, and drink all the delicious coal underneath your houses.
Right. Well, I mean, think about it. You know, you're on a separate piece of property and coming in at the slant. But yeah.
Similar, yeah.
So the state of Pennsylvania passed a law, Public Law 1198, which forbids the mining of anthracite coal in such a way as to cause the subsidence of any structure used as a human habitation. Yeah, makes total sense, right? So the Pennsylvania Coal Company sued to enjoin that statute from going into effect. And for the very first time, the Supreme Court said, you know what? That's right. We cannot imagine a world in which some poor coal company is not allowed to extract as much coal from the earth as possible. So for the first time ever, they said, quote, the general rule is that while property may be regulated to a certain extent, if regulation goes too far, it will be recognized as a taking. So in other words, we don't know exactly what too far means.
Yeah.
But saying you can't mine your coal out from under this property that you've leased to people whose houses are going to collapse into the earth is that's a bridge too far.
Well, okay. Monty Burns is advocate here.
Okay, good. Good.
I definitely see the principle of if a regulation, I don't know how you define too far, but like if a regulation does, let's say you and I enter into a deal. And I'm like, all right, I'm going to buy the coal rights or something not as poison the well-y. I'm going to buy the dirt rights. I don't know, something sustainable. Solar panel rights. There we go. I'm going to try to revamp this example so maybe get more sympathy. I'm going to buy some of this land here for solar panel rights because I love the environment. I want to help the environment. Going to build a solar farm. And then the government, for some reason, and maybe it's Republicans or something, they're like, we hate solar panels. We are now regulating no solar panels allowed here. Like we're just taking that away arbitrarily because we hate Thomas and his environment plan. It feels like I could be like, well, you really did just take away the thing. Like, let's say that's the only right I had to the land. Now that it's entirely, we made a deal and it's gone from I had a economic value in this thing to now I have zero. It does feel like the government's maybe taken something away from me there.
I love that that's the position that you've got, because that's the position that I want you to get to, right?
Oh,
in
cool.
other words,
I've changed my mind. I actually think it's fine. No, I'm just kidding.
Not only, as Justice William Brennan put it, and again, as I've mentioned, probably my jurisprudential hero, from the position of the landowner, the regulations that totally deprive you of all use of your property are indistinguishable from taking your property. Right.
Yeah.
And so what the Supreme Court has done since that 1922 Pennsylvania coal decision is proceed on kind of a case by case basis. And the best understanding of the law that we can summarize is that the Fifth Amendment is violated when a particular regulation denies an owner all economically viable use of his land.
Oh, but all is pretty. Yeah, that's doing a lot of work.
It's doing a lot of work now.
Thomas, you could still grow some grass and sell blades of grass from your land for 99 cents for the entire value.
And that's right. And so subsequent decisions have either omitted the word all or have changed that to all or substantially all. Mm-hmm. Right. So the test would then be. Denies you the economically viable use of your land, right? Because that's right. You know, yeah, you could set up a series of, you know, lemonade stands. People made those same arguments.
You could sell kind of pretty rocks that you find on the land to kids for 25 cents. Right. Economic value.
Yeah. And, you know, when you say, look, and again, I litigated one of these cases. It was an abandoned golf course that my client purchased. It was currently zoned a certain zoning designation when my client purchased it. And my client had a plan to develop like 80 single family homes within this fallow golf course. And then after my client purchased the land, the city council met and rezoned that golf course to such that like it would go from 80 houses to 4. Right.
Jeez.
And that was the issue we litigated on and won, that said, okay, yeah, we could build 4 houses here, but you know what? Like, they didn't spend, you know, $100 million so that they could build 4 houses, right? Like,
yeah.
You know, they spent the amount of money that they did consonant with the original development plan, and that was not an economically viable use of the land, you know, to pay 10 times, you know, what you could ultimately get for it. But I want to kind of come to the conclusion that you articulated as a common sense point, which is, notwithstanding its august beginnings in protecting the, you know, poor coal company, that yes, right, regulations can be the equivalent of a deprivation of use. And that, in my view, from a progressive standpoint, the questions I care most about are regulatory takings that, you know, deprive you of 90% of the use of your property, mm-hmm. or, you know, diminish the value by 90%, but still are, you know, economically viable. Because remember, those are the cases in which you get nothing. And this has been consistently reaffirmed by the Supreme Court. The most recent case on regulatory takings is a case called Murr versus Wisconsin in 2017, and in which, and again, I want you to remember the cable box case, right? Like, sticking 2 cable boxes was absolutely physical intrusion onto your property, physical taking, not a regulatory taking, and you have to recompense the owner. In this case, you had parents who were giving lots to their kids. Each lot, lot E and lot F, were both over an acre. But due to regulations, they had under an acre of developable land on each of the properties. And so the idea was, they first transferred lot E, then they transferred lot F, and plaintiffs had a deal to sell part of lot E and then get lot F over an acre and develop lot F. But Wisconsin passed a law that said, if you transfer any of these properties and they're under an acre of developable land, then you can no longer subdivide the property at all.
What the heck? Yeah, is there a lot of like small government, like lower level government lawmaking that's just like, I hate this guy, I'm going to F him over?
It's just like, I hate this guy.
Yeah.
Look, there is a reason to want to not allow property owners to infinitely subdivide their properties. But this does look kind of retaliatory here, right?
Yeah.
And this went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And basically the landowners were like, look, this law merges lot E and lot F into one parcel. And yes, we can still do the development on lot F that we were going to do, but we can't sell the lot E portion. So it is by regulation reduced the value of lot E to zero, because without the law, we could sell this other part. We could build, you know, and it's just that the reason it's split into two lots is an arbitrary nature of how they were conveyed to us. But we own both right now. Let us carve out the part. Like, we'll keep this over an acre. We'll develop some houses. And then, or I think it was just one house, right? Like, this is not a mega developer. And let us sell lot E to finance that. And the Supreme Court was like, nope. We're going to look at the overall economic effect to both lots. Since it doesn't deprive you of all economic value of the combined lots, jeez, just a regulation, you're, you know, SOL.
Wait, so I thought you said earlier that they changed it from all, but now it does sound like it's all? Because you just said 90%. Earlier you said like, oh, I'm concerned about the ones that take 90% of the value. So what is the threshold we're looking at?
There is no defined threshold. Here's what the Supreme Court has said. We have generally eschewed any set formula for determining how far is too far, preferring to engage in essentially ad hoc factual inquiries. So what counts as economic value? We don't know, right? It's case by case. Huh. And if you're asking yourself, should I care about that? You should 100% care about that for all the reasons that we've talked about. Here's what you should not care about or not be agitated about. Uh-huh. Kelo versus City of New London. This is a physical intrusion, direct takings case, right? It involves condemnation. So this is like bulldozing the houses to expand out the reservoir. And I want to start off because, you know, you'd sort of asked that question, and I want to quote from the plaintiff. And by the way, the reason for this is because the plaintiff is a member of sort of the modern media savvy set of plaintiffs. She is super sympathetic. She's really, really good at going on TV. And here's what she says, right? She says, "What galls me is that the developer is taking my land so someone else can live here. I don't understand why I'm not as good as someone else." There was an article that recently appeared in the newspaper that said they were going to put up 80 housing units on East Street. I live on East Street. That's what they want to do. They want to put up new houses. I'm not good enough to live here, yet someone else is good enough to live here. And that, A, has some real legal force, and B, I think, has some real persuasive force. So that is the argument why this case is terrible. Now let's explain out what the case is. Okay, and the case is urban renewal, right? So here's what happened. In 1998, Pfizer, so yeah, you want a villain, right? We all hate Pfizer, right? Well, not at present, thanks
to
COVID.
I have some Pfizer in me. I don't hate that part of the Pfizer.
No, but horrible, big, evil drug company. This is, again, why the stars are sort of aligning. They bought $10 million in land from the state of Connecticut along the Thames River. And that bordered on an area called Fort Trumbull in the city of New London, Connecticut. They bought the land, and Pfizer built a $270 million facility that brought 1,400 jobs into New London. In exchange for that, they got $118 million in subsidies and tax breaks over the next decade. And I just want to jump in and say, this is a huge problem that restricting eminent domain doesn't solve. And the problem is the communities are pitted against each other in a race to the bottom, right?
I hate it. Yeah.
It's awful. Okay. This case does not solve that in any way whatsoever. But again, it hijacks the libertarian argument in this case, hijacks your emotions on that kind of predatory behavior that companies use to extort benefits out of communities in order to muster opposition. So the plant was scheduled to be finished by 2001. And as Pfizer is moving in, they immediately set at work trying to influence the neighborhood with working with the city and then working with the Republican governor of Connecticut to engage in urban renewal redevelopment of the surrounding Fort Trumbull area. And again, this is a classic urban development situation. Fort Trumbull used to be a naval research facility. It closed in the 1990s with the end of the Cold War. And so it had a lot of empty stuff there. And it was an area that they hoped to revitalize. And in fact, it was an initiative pushed, like I said, by the Republican governor. One of the things that the Republican governor wanted to do was disaggregate the mayor of New London, who was a Democratic rival, right? And so, and again, I don't know that it would have turned out differently if he hadn't, but it's an important kind of fact in the background. So what the governor did was reinstated an entity called the New London Development Corporation, which was a state corporation nonprofit that was established to then aid the city with development planning. So the NLDC produced a development plan to revitalize Fort Trumbull, right, by building housing, office space, and commercial facilities, right? Restaurants, all that sort of stuff that would then also provide office space for the Pfizer headquarters. That development plan was obviously, right? We need to talk about the way in which these urban renewal projects get done. Yes, was done in close consultation with Pfizer, right?
Yeah.
And certainly would have benefited them. At trial, the language that was used to describe Pfizer's ties to the New London Development Corporation was, it was the, quote, 10,000-pound gorilla behind the project. And undoubtedly, that was the case. So the NLDC then sought to buy up all the land, right? That's the first step in these, is voluntarily acquiring the land. There were 90 different properties.
Oh, that's interesting. We didn't even touch on that. Is that a requirement? Yeah. You have to be just, oh, hi, I'm just a normal buyer, not going to demolish your house at all, just looking to buy. Do you have to do that first?
Most projects will have built in the acquisition costs of the property because as a practical basis, and again, this is why I come down on the side that I do, as a practical basis, it's cheaper to buy property even above, like, you know, what Zillow would say, you know, like it's cheaper to voluntarily buy the property than to have to go through the eminent domain route. Because you have to bring, you have to roll in your legal costs in addition to everything else. Whereas, you know, you're like, all right, look, I get 100% guarantee that you're going to move out of the property on X schedule if I just buy it from you. So most developers go through the voluntary process first. And that's what happened here. 90 different landowners, all but 7 of them sold voluntarily. Mm. And if you want to ask, think about the the Better Call Saul episode.
Yeah,
with the bank.
That's just what I was thinking about. Yeah, she's got to convince the old guy to give up his land.
Yeah, right. And do developers sometimes engage in, you know, sleazy tactics or heavy-handed tactics? Of course they do, right? So we want to have open eyes with this. But nevertheless, 83 people sell, 7 say, we're not going to sell. So in 2000, New London City Council authorizes the NLDC to use eminent domain to condemn the land of those who refuse to sell. Between those 7 property owners, they owned 15 residential properties. The face, like I said, was Suzette Kilo, who had a little pink house. So I'm going to include the libertarian organization that represented her pro bono and used her as the face. And I want to say used in a derogatory way.
Yeah, you find the most sympathetic face on your thing. Yeah.
So they characterize this as Suzette, this is directly from their website, quote, Suzette Kilo dreamed of owning a home that looked out over the water. She purchased and lovingly restored her little pink house where the Thames River meets the Long Island Sound in 1997 and enjoyed the great view from its windows. Tragically, the city of New London turned that dream into a nightmare. Word for word on their site.
Yeah, it didn't really turn the... Okay.
Yeah.
If I have a dream to own a house... And then it's just like, well, you don't get to own that house. You haven't turned my dream into a nightmare. You've just slightly altered my dream. The dream would be a nightmare. Would be like, now that house has teeth and it eats you. And then like, and you're not wearing any clothes and everybody's watching. And that would be like you turned the dream into a nightmare.
So
did that happen, Andrew?
No, that did not. That did
not that we know of. Okay.
This show is brought to you by HelloFresh. If you have been living on Mars or something and haven't heard me talk about HelloFresh, here's what it's all about. It's a meal kit that you're going to love. With HelloFresh, you get fresh, pre-measured ingredients and mouth-watering seasonal recipes delivered right to your door. You skip those trips to the grocery store and count on HelloFresh to make home cooking fun, easy, and affordable. And that's why it's America's number one meal kit. There is so much I love about HelloFresh. What to pick? Well, first and foremost, I find it really stressful to try to plan meals myself week in, week out. It seems like the weeks fly by and I'm never ready. Well, forget all that. HelloFresh cuts out the stressful meal planning and grocery store trips so you can enjoy cooking and get dinner on the table in just about 30 minutes. And then I think my other favorite thing is not wasting food. I hate wasting food. And with HelloFresh, you've got all those pre-measured ingredients, exactly what you need in the quantities that you need it. And their fresh ingredients are sourced directly from growers and delivered from the farm to your front door in under a week, contact-free, of course. I absolutely love HelloFresh. I think you're going to love it as well. Here's what you need to do. Go to HelloFresh.com/OA12 and use code OA12 for 12 free meals, including free shipping. Wow, 12 free meals. That's a lot of free meals. So if you want to get that, once again, go to HelloFresh.com/OA12 and use the code OA12 for 12 free meals, including free shipping. HelloFresh, America's number one meal kit.
And I want to point out they use this looked out over the house was, as far as I can tell, a quarter of a mile from the waterfront. And the best is the allegation in the complaint that, quote, on a clear day, she can see Montauk Point from her dining room window at the tip of Long Island, right? So again, you're led to believe like it's this, you know, waterfront property. It's a property with a view of the water. And
look,
all of this doesn't
matter at all, right? I mean, like the point is she wants her house, and that
she wants
should
her
all
house.
That right. it, what no matter what the ruling is here, it shouldn't hinge on, well, like, yeah, but does she like really want her house? Like, is she a super big fan of the water on her, nearby exactly. or not? It should be like, person wants their house. The law should be like, we're cool with the government taking that or not.
Exactly right. So what made this such a desirable case on legal grounds is that the question here was very, very simply presented, right? And it was, is economic redevelopment a public
Do
use?
Do you want to kill this poor old lady at her house?
Isn't it just a, you know, and then the other side, right? This is just a big giveaway to Pfizer. It's a it's a private interest. The government isn't interested. And what really made that a great test case from the legal perspective is because usually this kind of urban renewal is in areas that are blighted neighborhoods, right? So you have an additional benefit to the public in that blighted, like removing blighted neighborhoods is clearly a public benefit, right? Like where, rats and that sort of thing.
Look, I know this, we don't have time. It'll be a topic for another show, but I feel like there's going to be a ton of, if we dig into this, a ton of racism involved in a bunch of different cases of this.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you said that.
That for later.
I wanted to bracket that. Again, the declaration of urban blight is 100% steeped in racism. And again, this case does not solve that. The reason why this case was brought was so that libertarians didn't have to argue against governments determining rundown inner cities to be urban blight, which they strongly favor. Right. What they didn't want was government just being able to take property away from middle class white people. So that was the additional attraction here. So if you're sitting there thinking like, yeah, urban renewal like forces poor people out of their homes, 100% it does. This case was chosen specifically not to present that issue. So let's be clear what libertarians want. They want to restrict government power by any means necessary, and they especially want to reduce the power in urban areas because most mayors are Democrats and most urban residents aren't libertarians, to put it mildly. So they wanted a determination from the Supreme Court that economic redevelopment is not a public use, and therefore, that's a kind of thing that the government now can't do. And so whenever there's a thing the government can't do, libertarians win. So armed with their libertarian lawyers, Suzette Kilo went to trial. The trial court evaluated the 7 different parcels of land, and they upheld the takings on 6.5 of them.
6.5? Wow.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. The trial court said, yeah, economic development is a public use. And the issue was parcel 4A.
Hold on. Were they like, you have to build a fence around this poor lady's pink house and it has to stay there?
No. The issue was that parcel 4 was going to have 2 different uses. The part labeled parcel 4B was going to become a park and a marina. The 4A portion was set aside for, quote, park support. And you will see the libertarian site, you know, sort of mocks all of this. But basically, like, as they said at trial, like, yeah, this is going to be the parking, expanding the roadways, that the kind of stuff you do to get people off the roads and into the marina, right? Why have we not specified exactly what this is yet? Because the schematics of the marina and the park are likely to change. That, again, that is very typical in development. And so we want to know what the final marina looks like before we tell you what the parking lot is going to look like.
Makes sense.
Makes a lot of sense, right? But nevertheless, the trial court said, you know what? We're not sure that this is enough detail on 4A. So we're going to uphold eminent domain for economic development. We're going to hold eminent domain on parcels 1, 2, 3, 5, 6, 7, and 4B. But we're going to deny it on 4A. Huh. And so then both parties appealed up to the Connecticut Supreme Court. And the Connecticut Supreme Court affirmed the takings and reversed on 4A. So it said, yes, you can take all 7 parcels of land, all 15 properties, so long as you compensate the owners. Why did the Connecticut Supreme Court reach this decision? I think because of a 9-0 1984 Supreme Court case called Hawaii Housing Authority versus Midkiff, right? And by the way, this is a case that is unquestionably correct, and it's about land distribution in Hawaii. And I think anybody from the left who is critical of the Kelo versus New London decision, I think it is my hope that this case persuades you the other way. So that case had to do with the historical distribution of land in Hawaii. And I'm going to quote from the factual findings here. In the mid-1960s, the Hawaii legislature discovered that state and federal governments owned 49% of the land in Hawaii, right? That's wow. A lot of military bases, right? Another 47% was in the hands, across multiple islands, was in the hands of only 72 private landowners.
Yikes. Okay?
18 landowners with tracts of 21,000 acres or more owned more than 40% of the land on the Big Island. And on Oahu, the most urbanized of the islands, 22 landowners owned 72.5% of all of the land, right? And so what do you think the property owners did? They were like, well, yeah, we're never selling.
Yeah.
We're just going to rent. And by the way, we can charge whatever the hell we want.
Yeah, what are the citizens going to do? Walk out and build a house on the ocean?
Right, exactly.
Live so, underwater, I guess? Yeah, I hope, as you say, this sounds like a no-nonsense correct decision.
Yeah. So the legislature said concentrated land ownership skewed the residential rent market, inflated the prices for land when property occasionally did sell, and injured the public tranquility and welfare. So they passed a law. And by the way, they worked with these oligopolistic huge business interests at first, right?
Right.
So the legislature said, we just want you to, we're going to pass a law that requires you to break up and sell the lands that you're currently renting to homeowners. And again, I'm going to quote from the Supreme Court. However, the landowners strongly resisted this scheme, pointing out that significant federal tax liabilities they would incur, right? So when you make a profit on selling a house that isn't your primary residence and you don't then buy another residence, right, you that gets taxed as ordinary business income. So yeah, they would be paying 40% taxes on the sales of all these homes. And the legislature said, okay, well, we wouldn't want you uber millionaires in Hawaii to have to pay taxes.
Yeah.
So instead, we're going to come up with a compromise solution that is much more economically beneficial to you. And that is, we're going to condemn your lands. We're going to acquire them via eminent domain. We're going to pay you fair market value for your property. But because it's eminent domain and you haven't sold it, that doesn't trigger the income tax requirement, right?
Okay.
It makes the tax consequences way less severe while, quote, still facilitating the redistribution of fees simple, right? That is the ownership of the land entirely. So that was the bill. It said, we're going to use eminent domain. We're going to seize a whole bunch of residential property, and then we're going to sell it off to individuals in order to diversify so that we don't have 72 people owning all but 4% of the real estate in Hawaii.
Is this what that movie The Descendants, I think it's called, is about?
I don't know. Anyway.
It's about landowners in Hawaii or don't want to sell their property. So I think it's that. But it's been like 10 years since I've seen it.
So in what I'm sure will shock you to your core, the oligopolists oppose that law as well. And they went all the way to the Supreme Court to say,
All I picture is them just marching the Supreme Court, doing the crying with the money in their hands, like, I get money, you know. Was that their argument?
That was their argument was, it's not a valid public purpose because you want other people to own property. You can't take house from person A and then sell it to person B and say that's a public purpose. And the Supreme Court, 9-0, again, with plenty of 1984, plenty of conservative justices on the Supreme Court, said, of course it is, right?
Oh,
and they relied on a 1954 case called Berman versus Parker about redeveloping slums, and again put the asterisk with all that. Mm-hmm. But the holding of that case of those cases is the public use requirement, right, for to constitute a takings is, and I'm going to read the legalese and then explain it, thus coterminous with the scope of a sovereign's police powers. Now, what does that mean? That means if the state legitimately thinks that it is benefiting its people, that becomes a public use, right? Police powers are the powers that enabled governors and mayors to impose masking and social distancing requirements. It is the general idea that, hey, a governor, a mayor is accountable to the people within her jurisdiction, and so therefore she can pass laws that are designed for no purpose higher than the public good, right? Unlike U.S. Congress, which can't just say, we think it would be good for people if X happened, that, you know, you have to have a specific reason. You have to have, you know, interstate commerce or the like. The state has police powers, and they are the broadest possible exercise of the state's powers. So that was unambiguously the law from 1954 to the present, and that was what was challenged by the Kelo versus City of New London case. And by the way, I want to add the justification in the Hawaii case, because it is about to be reversed, and it's part of why Kelo is a good thing. What the Hawaii case said was, in our previous decisions, explaining that public use is coterminous with the sovereign's police powers, we emphasize the importance of deferring to legislative judgments about a public purpose. Courts are ill-equipped to evaluate the efficacy of proposed legislative initiatives, so we reject as unworkable the idea of courts deciding on what is and what is not a governmental function and invalidating legislation on the basis of a court's view on that question at the moment of decision, a practice that has proved impracticable in other fields. So again, the idea is, when it comes to urban redevelopment, your best method for being engaged is to be engaged in the community. Again, remember, most of these are democratic municipalities. Are there issues with unequal access to resources? 100%. It's an endemic problem. I do not mean to suggest that community residents have an equal footing with large corporations. They do not. But the court said, look, we're better off not saying that we're going to review all community decisions by some court down the chain. We would rather have the community come to this decision than Samuel Alito. And I wholeheartedly endorse that. So how did Kelo get up to the Supreme Court if it was so clear? And the answer is, the activist right wing at the time, Scalia, Thomas, Rehnquist, co-opted one of two centrists on the court at the time, Sandra Day O'Connor, to vote to grant cert. They thought they could pick off Anthony Kennedy, the other centrist. They were wrong, and that's why it's 5-4. So, first off, Kelo versus City of New London was not a weird alignment. It was totally straightforward. It was written by then-Justice John Paul Stevens, probably the most liberal member of the court at the time. It was joined by Souter, Ginsburg, Breyer, right? The court's left wing. Kennedy was the swing vote, and he wrote a concurrence that is truly excellent. So the result in Kelo was to affirm the judgment of the Connecticut Supreme Court, to say, yeah, redevelopment is a public purpose under the Fifth Amendment. It's a valid exercise of the local government's powers. And Kennedy wrote a concurrence to say, I want to reach out, you know, to at least to Sandra Day O'Connor, right? And he says, this court has declared that a taking should be upheld as consistent with the public use clause, so long as it is rationally related to a conceivable public purpose. This is a deferential standard of review, but it echoes the rational basis test used to review economic regulation under the due process or equal protection clause, right? It does not alter the fact that transfers intended to confer benefits on particular favored private entities with only incidental or pretextual public benefits are still forbidden by the public use clause. A court applying rational basis review should strike down a taking that, by a clear showing, is intended to favor a private party with only incidental or pretextual public benefits. And a court confronted with a plausible accusation of impermissible favoritism to private parties should treat that objection as a serious one, review the record to see if it has merit, though with the presumption that the government's actions were reasonable and intended to serve a public purpose. I think that makes a lot of sense.
Makes sense to me. Case closed. I think
you want to say, yeah, if this is nothing but a giveaway to Pfizer, if it is just they've bought and sold the legislature, yep, you can go to court. If it isn't, if it's the process of political horse trading, then it might not be the best possible outcome, but it is certainly a better outcome than saying we are going to constrain the power of local governments to do what they can to serve their communities. This was bitterly condemned by Rehnquist, Scalia, Thomas, and O'Connor, and O'Connor wrote the dissent. She makes essentially two arguments in her dissent, and I don't think either of these are very good. The first is, she says, this effectively reads out the public use clause from the Fifth Amendment. I think the bit I just read to you from Kennedy answers that, right? It's no more of a reading out than saying we apply the Equal Protection Clause under a rational basis. It's not much of a protection. I don't want to oversell that, but it doesn't have to be, because the state power comes with its own remedy of compensation. So that was the first argument. It kind of reads that into nothingness. And I would say it's no more nothingness than the rational basis test, which is not nothing. And then the second argument was sort of a liberal concern for how urban renewal works, which, again, I sympathize with, but I think this case wouldn't have solved. So she writes, the specter of condemnation hangs over all property. Nothing is to prevent the state from replacing any Motel 6 with a Ritz-Carlton, any home with a shopping mall, any farm with a factory. And I kind of want to combine that into the other argument, the last argument you will hear against Kelo versus City of New London today. And that is, this redevelopment plan ultimately went nowhere. It was proposed, and I'm going to quote here from withering criticism in the National Review that winds up being its own goal. As for the City of New London, Justice Zarella, that was the dissent at the Connecticut Supreme Court, and other skeptics turned out to be right. The NLDC's flawed development plan fell through, as did a number of later efforts, and today the land is empty and apparently overrun with feral cats. That's true. But wow. It's an own goal, because the reason Pfizer pulled out of New London was because after acquiring another company, Groton, Connecticut built the research facility that they were looking to have built on the New London facility. And then Pfizer's tax breaks expired in 2009. So they were like, oh, look, this other area was able to build the thing that we wanted to get out of the Fort Trumbull project. And by the way, if that had not been wrapped up in 5 years of litigation, maybe New London could have built that facility in the time. So yes, do we still have the endemic problem of the race to the bottom? 100%. We still have it. But opposing Kelo versus City of New London will not solve that problem. All it will do is say it will impose the hard and fast rule that says localities can't engage in urban renewal. And I think that is incredibly misguided. And so that is our deep dive.
Wow.
Kelo versus City of New London. What do you think?
That was fantastic. It was such an appropriate use of my 500th episode. I really, that was just such a signature Andrew Torres deep dive. I know we normally save those for the Tuesday show, you know, but like, screw it. It's 500. It was fantastic. I loved it. And so it sounds like the state of the law on this is okay, or is this another thing this horrible court is going to ruin in some weird way?
This is such an angry issue for libertarians and those really engaged in right-wing jurisprudence that I imagine the Supreme Court will revisit. And then we will see all of these articles about how, you know, Kelo versus City of New London is a decision viewed as controversial from both the left and the right. And I want to highlight that the criticisms from the left are intentional hijackings of what are good faith motives that this court is absolutely not going to solve by overturning it. I will also point out a bunch of states have passed laws restricting the eminent domain powers of local mayors, which, again, think about this, right? Like, governors tend to be Republicans, mayors tend to be Democrats. So this is an area where they got public sympathies behind governors taking away local powers from Democrats. And the entire history around this, I feel about Kelo versus City of New London roughly the way I feel about the McDonald's coffee case.
Yeah.
So there go.
Good callback on that. So something that's kind of widely misunderstood and bashed for bad reasons, essentially.
Exactly right.
Well, I love this. What a great way to celebrate 500, Andrew. That was so much fun.
And thank you!
And now it's time to thank our new patrons. And I am so excited to thank our new patrons on episode 500. What a special slice of history you have there. No, not really. They don't care. But that's fine. But you will get a lot of awful movies that I have not had time to edit because I've been on vacation. I've actually tried to find the time. It's been impossible. But I'm going to very soon. It's a lot of awful movies that is Cop Rock episode 2 with a special guest. It will be in your email inboxes, patrons, soon.
In your ear holes very soon. Yeah.
So the following new patrons may be enjoying that if they are at the $2 level. And that is, I'll start us. Thank you to S, Rubik's Tesseract, Maximum Bebo, Chris Harry, Benjamin Paul, Robert Sellers, and Robert Ward. Your turn, Andrew.
And thank you to Brendan Kirby, to Annie, to Spencer Darling, to 127.0.0.1, to Oliver Graff, and Jacob Gubau. Thank you so much for supporting the show. We really appreciate it. It's what enables us to do this.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
And now it's time for T3BE, special Disneyland edition. I think I have the maximum number of excuses that a person could have for definitely getting this question wrong, but here we go.
All right, Thomas. A man arranged to have custom-made wooden shutters installed on the windows of his home. Contractor who installed the shutters did so by drilling screws and brackets into the exterior window frames and the shutters. The man later agreed to sell the home to a buyer. The sales agreement did not mention the shutters, the buyer did not inquire about them, and the buyer did not conduct a walkthrough inspection of the home before closing.
Wow.
The man conveyed the home to the buyer by warranty deed.
What an appropriate real property question for eminent domain, you bastard.
After the sale closed, the buyer noticed that the shutters and brackets had been removed from the home and that the window frames had been repaired and repainted. The buyer demanded that the man return the shutters and pay the cost of reinstallation, claiming that the shutters had been conveyed to him by the sale of the home.
Oh, wow.
When the man refused, the buyer sued. Is the buyer likely to prevail?
Oh, shoot. I've never thought about this. Okay. I'm interested. This could be good practical information.
It really is. Yeah. A, no, because the sales agreement did not mention the shutters. B, no, because the window frames had been repaired and repainted after removal of the shutters.
Okay.
C, yes, because the shutters had become fixtures.
Ooh.
Or D, yes, because the man gave the buyer a warranty deed and the absence of the shutters violated a covenant of the deed.
I love this question. Doesn't mean I have any chance of getting it right, but I love it because I never thought about this. So it's like, what if I sell you my house? You know, it says they didn't do a walkthrough, which I don't know if that'll matter. But let's say you like the house, you see the house, you love the house. And then I'm just like, cool, deal's done. And I just take out everything in the house. Like, I take out doors, windows, wiring, you know, just like everything. Basically strip it bare of everything I possibly can. And then you're like, what the hell? I thought I bought a house. I'm like, yeah, you bought the house. I'm just taking all these things that go on the house that I still own or something. It's like, I'm doing an extreme. I take off the roofing, you know, just like, it's interesting. So there must be, and this is, again, entirely from just thinking it through, because I've never thought about this, but it's so interesting. There must be some sort of thing of like, well, okay, there's stuff that's definitely a part of the house that you can't just take. You can't take a wall with you after you sell the house or something, maybe. But maybe there's other stuff like, for example, furniture, you know, other minor things like that. That must be like, okay, yeah, that's reasonable. You know, you can't keep my TV because I sold you a house and my TV was in it or something, you know. So how do we balance that? What's the answer to the question going to be? No idea. We'll see if I know. We'll see if the coin knows. What sucks about this is, as much as the general thing is really interesting, this will come down to, well, the minutia of the definition of a fixture is going to be like dot to die, you know, because it was brackets and screws or something. So that will be probably what it is. But, I won't know the answer. But we'll go through it. It's interesting. Okay, A, no, because the sales agreement did not mention the shutters. I think that can't be right. You don't have to mention every single window frame and every single panel and every single roof shingle, you know. Otherwise, like, I'm taking that shingle because the agreement didn't mention it, I think. But then again, whenever the one time I bought a house, there's a whole lot of paperwork that I didn't read. So maybe they do have to go over everything with a fine tooth comb. So, but I'm eliminating A. I don't think that's it. B, no, because the window frames had been repaired and repainted after removal of the shutters, which is very plausible. B is a good plausible no answer. Because that sounds to me like when I put up something in my house, I don't know, some random thing. And I'm like, all right, moving away. I'm taking this with me, going to repair it so it's still a house. You know, I haven't ruined the house. But yeah, I'm this particular thing I'm taking with me. Seems like B could be the answer. C, yes, because the shutters had become fixtures. Totally reasonable answer there, too. It seems like there would be some principle at stake here that's like, well, something's a fixture of the house. You can't take the gutters with you or something, you know? D, yes, because the man gave the buyer a warranty deed and the absence of the shutters violated a covenant of the deed. I really don't think that's it. That strikes me as an answer that's trying to sound complicated enough to be correct. Like, oh, yeah, no, that sounds like a lot of words. And, you know, I could get burned by this. Maybe that's one of those answers that just restates the principle in a way that means it's a yes answer. But I don't think it's D. I think I'm solidly in B or C. We got B. We got a good no answer. Are the window frames fixtures or not? You know, and B says, well, the frames are repaired. It's still there. The shutters were removed, but like, you know, it's still a house, no harm, no foul kind of thing. And C is, yes, because the shutters had become fixtures. And I wonder if it's going to come down to the sentence in the first paragraph, which is, the contractor who installed the shutters did so by drilling screws and brackets into the exterior window frames and shutters. Is screws and brackets going to be the key there? Could totally be true that there's some other thing here that's going to be an exception, like, yeah, well, they could have taken them, but then you'd have to mention in the deed that the blah 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 something deal, you know, could be that. That could be a reason it's an A and D answer, but I'm not going to get it if it's that. I think I'm still between B and C. You know, here's what I'm going to say. This is close, like, but I think the shutters have become fixtures. I'm a little confused about what these shutters are, because like it says their brackets are on the exterior window frame. Are they exterior shutters? Usually your shutters are like inside, so you can, you know, not have to go outside to manipulate them. But I don't know, maybe that's just a weird construction thing. Like it had to reach around into the outside of the house. Anyway, I think, you know, could be totally wrong, but I think something that's been installed into the house in this way with screws and brackets, even though, you know, you can unscrew stuff and unbracket it, but whatever. I think I'm going to say that this is right over that line. It's close, but it's right over that line of like, this is a fixture of the house. You can't just take it with you. You can't take all the doors with you. Or maybe you could. I don't know. But I'm going with C, final answer. B is my second choice. Let's see if the coin is going to get me twice in a row. Let's flip a coin. Preparing to flip. The coin agrees with me. Okay, good. Good. Suitable for episode 500. The coin and I agree on answer C. Yes, because the shutters had become fixtures. And we'll see if the coin and I got it right.
And if you'd like to play along with Thomas and the coin, you know how to do that. Just share out this episode on social media. Include the hashtag T3BE. Include your guess, your reasons. Therefore, we will pick a winner and shower that winner with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune, not guaranteed.
Ah, and that's our show. I know. I just want to savor it. Episode 500, Eminent Romaine. We finally got there, Andrew. So much fun. I'm glad we saved it. Here's to another at least 5 more episodes. I'm going to say, no, sorry, 500. Here's to another 500 more.
All right. I'm in.
Congrats. But for real, congrats, Andrew. 500 amazing episodes of the show is an accomplishment. And you knock it out of the park. You're like Pujols with the Dodgers, you know? You're still knocking it out of the park.
I'm old and slow and occasionally get a hold of one. Okay, all right, fair enough.
Hey, he's having a good season. I thought that was a compliment.
No, I accept the compliment. I will also say, like, one of the things that I think is a defining characteristic of the show is, you know, your work ethic. And we've done 500 episodes. I think we've had 2 episodes that got delayed by a couple of hours due to forces beyond our control. But, you know, we delivered episode. We're the post office of podcasting, right?
Well, pre-Dijoy.
Yeah, pre-DeJoin. we deliver them on Christmas. We deliver them when we're off on holidays.
It's true.
You record here when you're, you know, you're out with your family at Disneyland.
Yeah, and, I think my wife's filing for divorce right now. I don't care. I got to record.
Well, you know, that's out there. It's got an OA to do. Abducted them.
Well, I appreciate
you really
that.
Set the tone for that. I think that's awesome.
Here's to 500 more for real, at least.
Absolutely.
Congrats, Andrew. All right, everybody. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time.
I move for a bad court thingy.
You mean a mistrial?
Yeah. That's why you're the judge and I'm the law talking guy.
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it will be a big help if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to join the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/yodelmountain and follow us on Twitter at openargs. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, all rights reserved. It is produced with the assistance of transcriptionist Heather Loveridge, production assistant Ashley Smith, and additional contributions from Morgan Stringer and Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our live shows and heads up the OA Wiki. Follow at OA Wiki on Twitter. Additional thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian Ziegenhagen, and Teresa. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith, who edits the show and created the fabulous theme music, which was used with permission.